On Tech News Today, the NSA's bulk collection of metadata is now officially illegal. Plus, we'll tell you what Google plans to announce at Google I.O. And if you've got one of those unlimited AT&T data plans, we've got some great news for you. Stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, May 7th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like apple pie oat clusters and dark chocolate pretzel pops, you'll never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox at naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is After Nine's content czar, Joe Panettiere. How the heck are you, Joe?
Mike, I'm doing well. How have you been?
I've been great, thank you. Now, you just got back from EMC World. Tell us, what was that like?
You know, Mike, it's really interesting because we talk so much about sort of the consumer side of IT here on the show and all the big consumer conferences. And then you go to EMC World and you forget, you know, there were 14,000 people there. A massive event. Yeah, mostly on-premises data center stuff. But a lot of talk about how, you know, we always talk about app stores and everything here on the show. But there's a real belief within EMC and within the rest of the IT world that the next generation app stores are actually going to live on premises within large corporations. So really interesting conversation there, but it's good to be back on the show.
Yeah. And of course, unlike the consumer shows, they, you know, people are not buying zero margin smartphones. They're buying big, big dollar items, companies that would actually send somebody to EMC World are spending millions or, you know, tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars on IT. And of course,
you are correct, sir.
Yeah. And so there is it's a huge business that, you know, a lot of consumers don't even give a second thought to. But of course, if you really want to get into that world, make sure you watch Twiet, Padres Own, This Week in Enterprise Tech, right here on the Twit Network. Well, Joe, why don't we jump into the news? An appeals court today ruled that the NSA's bulk collection of telephone metadata is illegal. The three-judge Second Circuit Court of Appeals asserted that harvesting the metadata of American citizens, quote, exceeds the scope of what Congress has authorized, unquote. Mark Joseph Stern wrote about the court's ruling for Slate and joins us now. Welcome to you, Mark.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being on. Now, did the court rule that mass metadata surveillance is a direct violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution?
No, the court decidedly did not rule that. Instead, the court simply decided that by collecting so much data indiscriminately with no reasonable suspicion that the people who are creating the data, who are making the calls, might be related to terrorists, the NSA was just exceeding what Congress said it could do. Congress said you can collect tangible objects so long as they are somehow related to some kind of suspicion that there's terrorist activity. And the NSA took that simple mandate and said, we're going to take all the telephony metadata that exists. That's not what it was authorized to do. And so the court said, you're breaking the law. And then the court said, because we can resolve this on this pretty simple, basic statutory ground, we don't need to reach the Fourth Amendment question.
Yeah, just to clarify there, Mark, let's talk a little bit about the Fourth Amendment question and also the players here. So as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, this case was driven by the American Civil Liberties Union. And were they basically trying to clear a ruling that the NSA's actions violated the Fourth Amendment? And ultimately here, did the American Civil Liberties Union win?
Yes. So to your first question, the ACLU is very much trying to get a court ruling from an appeals court and ultimately from the Supreme Court that holds that if the NSA collects a ton of data from people with no suspicion that certain individuals are actually terrorists, that that violates the Fourth Amendment and that it constitutes an unreasonable search or an unreasonable seizure of people's personal effects. You know, when I make a call to an abortion clinic or a suicide hotline. The NSA winds up getting the information that I, Mark Joseph Stern, made that call. Not that I have made such calls, but you get the idea. That is very personal information, and the NSA is snooping on it. Then the ACLU would like for a court to say that in itself is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. However, the ACLU is certainly happy with today's ruling, because what it did was say, look, Congress, you're on notice. We don't like this kind of program. If we did reach a constitutional decision, we would probably say it's unconstitutional, but we don't need to reach that decision. And we're giving you enough time to repeal or let expire this statute. So the problem with the ruling is this: because the court did not rule that the did not squarely rule that the program is unconstitutional, Congress could theoretically come back and just rewrite the program, rewrite the mandate, say everything the NSA is doing right now is perfectly acceptable and it's what we authorize. And then you would have no statutory problem. And every court that addressed this issue would have to go right to the constitutional question.
Personally, I think that it absolutely should be ruled unconstitutional. I think that people who think that it shouldn't don't understand the power of metadata. In my own view, I think the metadata is actually more telling than the data. For example, if you know what somebody said, but don't know what who they said it to or when they said it or where they were when they said it and all that rest of the metadata, then that's less useful than the fact that this person is in contact with that person 12 times a week. And then, you know, that kind of information is very, very damning for anybody who is trying to have their privacy respected and so on. But shifting gears a little bit, they actually credited Edward Snowden for this ruling. They said, you know, essentially that this ruling would not have taken place without the leaks by Edward Snowden. Were you surprised by this, essentially them giving props to Edward Snowden?
I wasn't surprised at all, because it's the only way the ACLU could get this case to court. Before the Snowden leaks, the ACLU had tried several times in several different courts to represent cell phone customers who wanted to sue the NSA and say, look, we aren't quite sure what you're doing, but we're pretty sure it's unconstitutional and that you're snooping on us without any reasonable suspicion. And almost every single court said, look, you're just a Verizon customer. You don't have any proof that the NSA is actually snooping on your metadata. It was pure speculation back then, which is in 2007. Fast forward to 2013, 2014, and today, we have the NSA documents that state specifically every single Verizon customer was surveilled by the NSA between a certain period. And because we have that information, because the ACLU has that information, they can march into federal court and show them the Snowden documents and say, my clients were snooped on by the NSA. And they now have standing to challenge that surveillance. It moved the challenge from speculative to very much concrete.
So, Mark, with everything that you're saying here and with the ruling, why didn't the court issue an injunction that orders the NSA to stop bulk collection of all this metadata?
So it's a great question, and you can tell that the court really, really wanted to. But there's a fundamental idea of judicial restraint when you're talking about a statute passed by Congress. And you want to do everything you can to not strike it down and not hold it up. And so what the court said is, look, this law that we're talking about, which is Section 215, this bulk collection law, is about to expire. It's going to expire in a couple of weeks. So we're not going to take the extra step of stopping it, of halting it, or of striking it down right now. We're going to basically toss the ball back into Congress's court with the very firm warning that if Congress does not take care of this, like I said, either let it expire or seriously modify it, then it's going to wind up back in our court and we're not going to be so nice to it next time around.
Interesting way to put it. Well, Mark Joseph Stern writes for Slate.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at MJS_DC. Thanks for joining us today, Mark.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right. Let us know what you think about this issue by sending email to tnt@twit.tv. Do you support the court's ruling? Do you think Snowden is a hero or a traitor? Just whatever's on your mind, let us know. More news in a sec, but first, let's talk about NatureBox. NatureBox is the healthy snack alternative that makes it super, super easy to eat better, because what happens to all of us is that when we get hungry and it's between meals and we decide to snack, we pretty much grab whatever sounds good that's nearby. And if junk food is nearby, and of course in the United States especially, junk food is always nearby. There's always a vending machine, or you know, you're around town. It's really easy to pick up some junk. And you can avoid that by always making sure you have healthy snacks nearby. And you do that by going to NatureBox, naturebox.com/twit, and trying their free trial of favorite snacks. You just paid $2 for the shipping. That's right. If you got $2 and you want to try NatureBox, you can do that by going to naturebox.com/twit. And if you always have these, they'll be delivered right to your door, so you don't have to go shopping for them. And they'll introduce you to new flavor combinations that will blow your mind. They're so delicious. Jalapeno white cheddar popcorn, carrot, strawberry, fruit chews, sea salt, pop pops. They go on and on. They're very creative, very innovative. And sometimes you see a title and you're like, it's like that IBM Watson recipe maker. They're really interesting, unusual, unexpected flavor combinations. And then when you try it, you're just blown away. They have this, you know, blueberry coated almonds. That is something you've never heard of before, but when you eat them, they're just delicious. And again, it's real food. It's not junk food. It's real food. And of course, it's much, much healthier than any of the junk food you're going to find on the snack aisle. Zero artificial flavors, zero artificial colors, zero artificial sweeteners, 0 grams of trans fat, and no high fructose corn syrup. And again, it's real food, tastes great, and it's very, very affordable, especially if you want to give it a try. Right now, if you go to naturebox.com/twit, you can get a trial of their favorite snacks delivered right to your door for just the $2 for shipping. What are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/twit and start your trial today. And we thank NatureBox for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Google's big developers conference is just 3 weeks away. It begins May 28th. And yesterday, the Google I.O. schedule was posted. As always, it revealed a lot about what Google plans to announce. Ron Amadio is reviews editor for Ars Technica and joins us now to talk about this. Hey, Ron, how you doing?
I'm great, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Now, you combed through the schedule. What was the biggest news you found in there?
They always try to censor these things like it's an early schedule, so they kind of try to keep the spoilers to a minimum. But somebody messed up and mentioned Android M by name. So this is going to be not the next version of Android, but a developer preview for the next version of Android. So last year they launched Android L, and I guess it's kind of the same thing this year. We'll get like a sneak peek of what's coming up, I guess. They also announced there was a lot of stuff in there about multi-screen Chromecast sessions, and that's probably the Chromecast 2. Last year, some Google exec did an interview and said that a new version of the Chromecast was coming, and it would enable a lot of multi-screen stuff. So while we don't have like a direct confirmation, they said Chromecast 2 would do a lot of multi-screen stuff. There's a lot of multi-screen Chromecast sessions, so we're probably going to see a new piece of hardware. What else? There was something in there about voice access where you'll be able to control every single part of an application with your voice. The people giving this talk have a background in accessibility, so I'm not sure if it's something normal people would want to use, I guess, but it's just going to end up that you're going to have a ton more voice commands for maybe while you're driving or something that would be very useful. And ATAP, Google's like DARPA style crazy skunkworks factory, is going to have some kind of a wearable there that they say a wearable that we hope will blow your socks off. We mean this more literally than you might think. So I don't know what they – I have no idea what they mean by that. But they've already done like really crazy stuff, like a digital tattoo on your forearm that you could press your phone against and it would like authenticate it. And the ATAP comes up with all sorts of weird stuff. And they're also in charge of like Project Aura and Tango and stuff like that.
Hey, Ron, let's rewind a little bit. Let's talk a little bit more about Android M. That's what you led the conversation off with here, and we'll definitely get to the other items as well. But Android M, any clues as to what this upgrade is or what new features we may see in it?
The first time we heard about Android M was last year from a Reuters report that had said Google was going to turn it into a car operating system. So there's Android Auto right now, but that's not an operating system. That's just a casted interface in the same way that CarPlay isn't iOS. So this would be like an actual car infotainment platform where like the car runs Android. And then there's probably going to be a fingerprint sensor API, which almost made Lollipop and they canceled at the last minute, and it's in AOSP right now. We've seen split screen mockups from Google, which have got to show up in an operating system at some point. Samsung and LG and all these other companies already do that. That's it for now. I don't know what else is going to be in M, but we'll see.
Now, they accidentally revealed an Android for Work update. What more can you tell us about that and what you think it might be?
The description said that Android for Work would come to more devices. So right now it's kind of limited to organizations that don't need super high security. So like it'll split home and work into two different sets of data and you'll get two different apps for it. And I guess there will be some kind of new security features that make that split even more acceptable for like super high security companies that need, you know, serious like enterprise solutions for this stuff.
Hey, what about Polymer? I think you had covered that in your story as well. Polymer 1.0. What exactly is that? Any clues?
Polymer is a UI toolkit that Google's building on top of web components. So it kind of turns websites into like this app enabled. It looks like an application, basically, like an Android app. But it's a website and it has really smooth animations. So if you look at the Google I.O. site, that's probably written in Polymer because it's got buttons and all these screen transitions. And like when you click on stuff, it'll fade out and there's slidey menus everywhere. And they're trying to bring the kind of app style interface to websites. And supposedly, Google promised material designs for all their websites last year, and it never really happened. But Polymer seems like a way to get there. So maybe they were waiting for Polymer to come out before they, you know, do a material redesign of Gmail and whatever else.
One of the most intriguing things from your story was this mention in the schedule of an Earth in real time session. Do you think they're actually going to announce something that is what that sounds like, which is that, you know, you watch something like Google Maps, but real-time satellite video or photography?
Oh, yeah, that's a quote from the session. It's the Earth in real time. So they bought a company called Skybox a bit ago, and they were going to launch, I think, 24 satellites just for, like, high-resolution video of the Earth. And they even demoed one or two feeds of this. So it's not going to be the entire Earth or anything, but I think you will be able to get, you know, real-time video of just kind of a section of the Earth, whatever they deem to be interesting at whatever given time. So, you know, it's definitely possible. It's just not going to be the whole Earth. It'll be parts of it. And they'll need to figure out what to do with all that data. Like, that's what the talk's about. Like, when we have this crazy, you know, video feed from outer space, what do we do with it? What analytics can we run on it? Stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting you bring that up, actually, Ron, because just earlier this week, Google announced a big data platform that runs on NoSQL, NoSQL. So it's really interesting to see Google exposing sort of the big data tool sets, but also then using it for all the new stuff they're developing in-house as well. Hey, a toy question for you, sort of speak. I've been to Google I.O. I left 1 year with a Samsung tablet. I left another year, I think, with a Chromebook. Any idea what the quote-unquote big handout may be this year? And will there even be one? Any clues?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we'll probably all get Chromecasts. It's too early for phones and it's too early for phones and tablets. I mean, maybe we'll all get Nexus 6s for Project Fi or something. But I don't know too much in the way of hardware. If you'd asked me a few months ago, I would have said a Chromebook Pixel 2, but that came out already. So I have no idea. I don't know what kind of hardware they're going to give out.
Last year, the big surprise was Google Cardboard. Sundar Pichai said, hey, you know, we've been working on this thing. Check it out. Let us know what you think. And then they handed out Google Cardboard, and that was a complete mind blower. A real fun thing, and that was not something that was expensive on their part either, obviously, made out of cardboard. Now, everybody likes to guess and speculate about what the letters for the versions of Android will stand for, and I'm curious, and we might as well start it, the season has begun, what is the M going to stand for? Is it going to be marshmallows, M&Ms, Macaroons, what's your guess?
Oh, man, I don't know. Marshmallows is a good one. I haven't thought about it too much. And after they did Kit Kat, like a brand name with a company, it's just the doors are open for anything, man. But, yeah, I'll put my money on marshmallow for now.
All right. And to your point, it could be M&M's. We'll see if Slim Shady likes that one. Well, Ron Amadio is at ArsTechnica.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Ron Amadio. Thanks for joining us today, Ron.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
Let us know what you think the M stands for. Send email to tnt@twit.tv. Nintendo and Universal Parks and Resorts today announced plans to build theme park attractions based on Nintendo video games. Sandra Pettuccini is tourism reporter for the Orlando Sentinel and joins us now. Welcome to you, Sandra.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, did the company give any hints as to which game titles might be turned into rides or attractions? Do you have any guesses?
They did not give any information. There was frustratingly little information in the press release. But, you know, I would guess that they would go with some of the characters and the games that have the most mass appeal, since that's what theme parks are all about. You know, you have Zelda, which is beloved by children and their parents alike, and the Mario Brothers. I would guess those are a couple of the ones that you're going to see in the Universal theme parks.
Hey, Sandra, this is Joe Panettiere. I happen to be a theme park junkie, and I happen to be a Nintendo junkie. So this is, you know, sort of the best of both worlds, potentially, for me. Wondering if you have any clues.
And you also go to Orlando a lot, too.
Yeah, right? So it's a triple play, actually. And I was going to get to the Orlando angle in a second. You know, the Orlando parks, if you go to Universal Islands of Adventure, you've got the Harry Potter area there. Do you think Universal is going to build out sort of a park within a park the way they did with Harry Potter? Or do you think it's just going to be one or two rides that are, you know, as you're walking the park, there's the ride, but it's not a dedicated Nintendo area per se. Any clues?
No clues, but, you know, certainly lands are a big thing for theme parks right now. Universal just opened its second Harry Potter land here in Orlando last year, and it's been a huge success. And, you know, Disney is planning a lot of Star Wars attractions, and a lot of people think that maybe Star Wars lands will be part of that. So lands, I would say, are a very big possibility. Universal is certainly on a roll right now with its theme parks, and they are saying that they're planning one new attraction each year at each of their major theme park locations.
Now, do you think that this, you know, pulling content or characters from video games and building theme park rides or attractions from that intellectual property, do you think that's a trend or an emerging trend, or is this something just completely isolated and unique?
Oh, intellectual property is definitely a huge trend for theme parks right now. You look at Disney, they are focusing very, very heavily on their franchises, much more than they did a few years ago. Frozen is huge for them, and they're going to be opening a Frozen ride at Epcot. And, of course, they bought Star Wars outright a couple of years ago. They bought Lucasfilm, and that's going to allow them to do huge things with Star Wars in their theme parks as they prepare to open the seventh Star Wars movie later this year. Harry Potter, of course, has been just absolutely huge for Universal. And right now, it's just all about the theme parks trying to get the best IPs they can and develop them.
Hey, Sandra, for those of us who are planning future trips to Orlando, here's a question for you. Right now, the Universal Studios Park, which we're talking about with these potential Nintendo rides, that Universal Studios Park has a lot of Marvel rides, Spider-Man, Hulk, et cetera, but yet Disney owns those brands now, correct?
That's right. There's a special deal that's in place where Marvel can keep, where Universal can keep the Marvel characters that it has over on this side. So there's been a lot of speculation about what's going to be happening with those Marvel characters.
Sandra Pettuccini is at the Orlando Sentinel. Actually, the website is orlandosentinel.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Sandra Pettuccini. Thank you for joining us today, Sandra.
Thanks for having me.
AT&T has been criticized for how it throttles LTE service for unlimited data customers like me. And now they've changed their policy. John Brodkin is a senior IT reporter for Ars Technica and joins us to talk about this. Welcome to you, John.
Thanks. I didn't know you were an AT&T unlimited customer. Have you been throttled?
I don't know. I just ignore it, but I've got it and I'm never giving it up. I'm going to cling to it until my dying day.
And, okay. Sounds like a great bumper sticker. Yeah. Have you been throttled?
Have you been throttled today? Yeah, have you been throttled by AT&T today? Well, what was AT&T's old throttling policy and what is their new one?
So their old throttling policy for LTE users who have the older unlimited plans is once you hit 5 gigabytes of data in a month, you're throttled for the rest of the month. So you get a fraction of the speed you're supposed to. And this throttling happened 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even if you were in an area when the network wasn't congested at all. This was different than the other throttling policies imposed by the other carriers, which limited the throttling only to areas where the network was congested. And AT&T has finally changed it so that its users will now only get throttled after they hit 5 gigs and only in congested areas.
Hey, John, did AT&T officially announce this or did you stumble upon it? How exactly did the details emerge?
Someone pointed it out to me that the language had changed on the website. But no, they didn't make an official announcement.
Is this going to affect the FTC lawsuit, do you think?
I don't think so, because the FTC lawsuit is going after past behavior. And in fact, the FTC can't go after AT&T for what it does now because of the recent ruling that reclassified AT&T and other ISPs as common carriers. The FTC, their authority is limited to prior to that ruling. AT&T actually argued that the FTC doesn't have authority to go after them at any time, even in the past, but a judge has already rejected that. So as of now, that lawsuit is going forward and the FTC is trying to get refunds to consumers who, well, like you.
Hey, John, was FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler involved in this at all? Did he influence this change?
He might have, because he has been pretty outspoken on this. Last year, he basically forced Verizon to not do any throttling of LTE users. And the new net neutrality rules do have rules against throttling. And there is an exception for reasonable network management. So you can throttle if it's reasonable for managing your network. But it would have been very hard for AT&T to argue that it was necessary to throttle people 24 hours a day. And so those rules do go into effect next month. And so by changing the policy a month before those rules go into place, they would probably be safe from any sort of punishment based on the net neutrality rules.
Gosh, I wish I could be bound by laws and rules that use the word reasonable. Officer, I was driving at a speed that was reasonable under the circumstances, 100 miles an hour. I was in a hurry, man. What are you going to do? John Brodkin is at ArsTechnica.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at JBrodkin. Thanks for joining us today, John.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let us know what you think of AT&T's throttling policy. Send email to tnt@twit.tv. Well, Meerkat launched a development platform yesterday, opening up the live streaming service to developers. Carissa Bell is a reporter for Mashable and joins us to talk about this. Hey, Carissa, how you doing?
Hey, Mike, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. Now, Meerkat says 37 developers have already created Meerkat-enabled apps. You mentioned Meerkat Stats, for example, which was created by Twit's business analyst, Jeff Needles, and my neighbor right here in the brick house. What other kinds of apps exist already for Meerkat?
Well, you mentioned the one that does statistics. There's also an apps that, you know, sort of curate streams and make it easier for people to, you know, sort of just like find what's out there. Because I think that's, you know, that's one of the challenges that a lot of, that, you know, Periscope and Meerkat have both had is just, you know, it's hard for users to find, you know, streams they're interested in if they're not thoroughly following a few people.
Hey, Carissa, these APIs, are they available yet? And what do you think they'll allow developers to do that they couldn't do before? And any clues there, or is it too soon to say?
I think to some extent it's too soon to say. The APIs are available now. And, you know, as far, like on the Meerkat side, they've put up some guidelines for developers. And it sounds like most things are fair game. They, you know, they have a few core rules that they want people to abide by, like don't enable anonymous viewing, you know, because that's very important for them to, like, you know, so to not have that anonymity factor. You know, but other than that, it sounds like it's pretty much fair game.
It's nice to hear a company that's humble enough to suggest guidelines and compare that to Apple, which is like, we will crush you if you violate any of our rules. Now, do you expect Twitter's Periscope to follow suit and release their own developer platform anytime soon?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people, that was kind of, you know, where their minds went right away. You know, it's interesting because Twitter doesn't really necessarily have the best history when it comes to, you know, embracing developers, so to speak. So I would be surprised that they open it up to the same extent that Meerkat has. But on the other hand, they have, you know, made a shift over the last, you know, year or so to try and sort of win back developers. So, I guess you never know.
Hey, Carissa, I have a question for both you and Mike, because I'm interested in both your views on this. So this past weekend was the big fight in Las Vegas, right? And there were a lot of issues with all these video streaming apps, actually people streaming the boxing fight using their phones, et cetera. I'm wondering, with these APIs coming, Carissa, do you think we may see apps where if there's four sides to a boxing ring, for instance, and there's four people, one each seated on each side of the ring, so to speak, could we see apps where we're automatically cutting from one person's view to another, and ultimately we all become instant television producers, so to speak, and it just becomes an even richer experience out there?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting idea. I think that's definitely, you know, I think some people are definitely thinking along those lines. You know, when you talk about, you know, this fight that just happened and, you know, one of the big things that always comes up is, you know, copyrights and, you know, how these streaming services are going to, you know, deal with these issues, which I don't think has really been addressed yet. So I think, you know, on that side, we kind of have to wait and see how that will play out. But I think, you know, definitely like people are already thinking about, you know, those kinds of ideas.
It's a great idea, and I definitely want it, Joe, but the problem is that the streams are not actually live. They're delayed by anywhere between 5 and 30 seconds, and different people are delayed by different amounts. So if you actually were switching before...
So we still need Jason in the background, right?
We still need Jason in the background. Jason told me to say that.
Yeah.
There's something to that, to have multiple camera, because it's exactly like you said. There have been multiple events. In fact, the big fire in New York City was one of the first sort of emergency type of situations where there are multiple people meerkatting that event. And it would have been great to be able to just toggle through a specific event. And, you know, it would also give you, actually, the delay could give you a benefit, which is a kind of instant replay if you want. You just toggle through and I want to see that again and go through the one that hasn't covered it yet or whatever. I think it's a great idea, and we have a lot of developers who watch this show. So if you're watching this, come on, get on it. And if barring that, Jeff Needles can probably create something as well. So very interesting idea, Joe. In fact, maybe it's another business for After Nines. So who knows? Well, Carissa Bell is at Mashable.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at CarissaBE. Thanks for joining us today, Carissa.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. CNET is reporting that Samsung plans to reveal new chip platforms for the Internet of Things. The new hardware will be called Arctic, according to CNET. That's spelled A-R-T-I-K. Interestingly, the technology comes not from the company's South Korean headquarters, but from Samsung's Silicon Valley-based Strategy and Innovation Center. The Arctic platform will be unveiled Tuesday during a keynote at the Internet of Things conference in where else? San Francisco. Joe, is this a good business for Samsung? I have my own opinion, but I want to hear yours. Do you think they should be getting into the Internet of Things chip business?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I say that is, you know, there's the chip piece of it, Mike, but then we really have to think about these things as sensors and data producing types of endpoints.
Yeah.
And so I think Samsung has an opportunity to play there, but then one of the bigger opportunities actually is with all those sensors out there, what type of data is being produced and then how does it flow back to data centers? So the data centers are all going to get bigger. And then what types of analytics tools are going to use to manage all that data and analyze all the data? So there are multiple sort of pieces to the Internet of Things puzzles in terms of where the opportunities are. I think the chips are only one piece of it, but certainly a huge piece.
I agree. And Samsung, I think, is uniquely well suited for all of it. I think they could really be a huge player. They're kind of losing it in the smartphone market. And of course, that's all relative. They're still by far the number two smartphone company in terms of a business profits and revenue and so on. And they certainly are number one now, again, in terms of market share. But I think that the smartphone racket is not a long-term good play for Samsung compared to something like the Internet of Things, home automation, and all the rest, because I think that they are so they have their fingers in so many different pies. In fact, you know, they make a lot of the home appliances that will be part of the Internet of Things revolution. They have, you know, they do the chip design. They do all of it. So I think that they really have a big opportunity to reemerge and become the Apple of the Internet of Things, if you will. Facebook launched today a new format for native mobile advertising. The company says their new format will make it easier to place ads into apps through the Facebook Audience Network. The modification makes native ads, which are designed to look like articles, look even more like the content in the apps. Facebook says native ads are more engaging. Critics say users engage more because they don't know their ads. Joe, any thoughts on this? Is this a good thing for Facebook users, or is this a bad thing for them?
You know, I sort of have a conflict of interest here. My conflict of interest is this. On the one hand, Afternize is watching Facebook really closely and intrigued by what they're up to. On the other hand, at the present time, Afternize has no plans and is not building, you know, sort of a content platform, so to speak. But we do look at how ads and content are served up. And I think the big thing is particularly the advertisers and or the content managers, they don't want yet another platform to manage. So I think the real challenge here is for the advertisers in particular, is there one dashboard they could be using to get their images, their messages, their medium to flow across what I would call native web, Mike, you know, and HTML5, and then across big screen PC, tablet, phone, on web, but then also flow out to applications native, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, et cetera. That's the key that I think is still missing here. We're still so siloed. It's like, well, if you go to Facebook, you have to use that ad system. If you go to Twitter, you have to use that ad system. Is someone going to hack together some sort of single screen approach to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also has to be said that I think the public is confused about native advertising and doesn't really quite understand it. And there's a lot of misinformation that's flying around out there. A lot of people are against native advertising. And in fact, native advertising is a great idea as long as the advertisements are clearly labeled. If the user or the reader is confused that it's an ad or think that it isn't an ad, that's terrible. But if they know it's an ad, it's a beautiful format. Some things are not like Coke and Pepsi where it's like, hi, try this. It's refreshing. You know, a lot of products, especially in technology, are more complex than that and have to be explained. That's all an ad is information. It's persuasive information designed to get you to understand and like the product that they're selling. And so people tend to confuse native advertising with advertorial content. They're very different things. So, for example, if a storage company has somebody write an advertorial, that article is going to be about storage. It's going to go on and make the case, and it's going to look like a regular article to a certain extent, hopefully labeled clearly, but it's going to be about storage. Most of the native content that's out there can be about anything except storage. In other words, it's a way to sort of gather eyeballs, and the companies become publishers of content to gather eyeballs so that then they can present ads to it. So they're completely different in terms of what the content is and what the whole messaging and pitch is. So, for example, if you go to Forbes.com, they have they're very pioneering in terms of advertorial, and they've got, I mean, in terms of native advertising. And if you notice, the companies that are behind the native advertising are never mentioned. Their category is never mentioned. It has nothing to do with the product they're selling. They're just publishing technology content.
Thought leadership.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So a lot of thought leadership stuff. But I tell you though, Mike, I do worry about it because this native advertising stuff, to your point, number one, it's really important for the vendor, whoever's producing the content, as well as the platform provider, such as Facebook, to disclose this relationship, number one. Number two, you know, for all the popularity of this stuff, not to pick on Facebook, but I will just for, and not Facebook, but Forbes, just for 1 second. their valuation is plummeted because they keep on cranking out more and more content. And in my opinion, there's less and less filters. And everyone is just, it's a free-for-all in terms of how much content these sites are pumping out. And ironically, the content's becoming less valuable and driving down the valuation of some of these media companies.
Yeah, it's kind of Huffington Post model.
Yeah. You know, but Facebook's the exception to the rule. Their valuation has been quite impressive, to say the least.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting to see how this is happening. And again, you know, you and I worked together at Windows Magazine back in the 90s. And in those times, you know, we'd get advertorial that mimicked the Windows Magazine typeface and all that kind of stuff. And we rejected them flat out.
Right.
So, no, you can't place that ad. You need to do something else. And so it really, at the end of the day, it's up to the publication. It's not up to the advertiser to make sure that distinction is very, very clear. Anyway, enough about advertising. We got some more news for you in just a second, but first let's tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle, you know them and love them as the best place to sell your used gadget. They have a great reputation for buying and making the buying process super, super easy and paying top dollar. I mean, we've all done it, tried to sell something to somebody on Craigslist or whatever. It's kind of a weird thing to do. You're meeting strangers in some parking lot somewhere to make this exchange, and people generally aren't going to pay that much for what you're selling. But on Gazelle, they know exactly what the value is, and they will pay that value. So it's really fantastic. But also, recently, they started selling devices. So if you want to buy a device from Gazelle, it's a great place to do it because, of course, they put everything through a 30-point inspection to make sure everything works beautifully. And they also have a 30-day risk-free return policy. So if you're thinking, gosh, I don't want to take the risk on a pre-owned device. I've only bought new devices in the past. I'm not sure I want to do this. There is zero risk, literally zero risk, 30-day risk-free return policy. Super, super easy to do. And they will give you a really, really great price on each device that you buy through Gazelle. So find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute, go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, and find out what it's worth. And we thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. We've been reporting on the regular watch industry's response to the smartwatch revolution, which kicked into high gear last month with the launch of the Apple Watch. Swatch CEO Nick Hayek said at a conference today that Swatch plans to ship an NFC watch this summer capable of making payments just like the Apple Watch can. The big difference, of course, will be that the Swatch will probably last 6 months instead of almost an entire day. He also said the NFC chip would add less than $6 to the price of the watch. So it sounds like my reading of this is that he's implying they're going to put e-commerce capability or mobile payment capability into regular Swatches, those plastic low-cost devices, and you know, raise the price by about $6. Joe, do you think that this kind of response is going to save the conventional watch industry from the onslaught from the smartwatch revolution?
You know, I don't know if it'll save it. I think there's a segment of the world that just is not ready for these wearables and mobiles. And what I mean by that is think about how often we all go into, whether it's a coffee shop or a retailer, and how many people are not using any type of mobile payment system. I mean, it's not that much of a hassle to take a credit card out of your wallet. In some ways, all these mobile devices are trying to solve problems that a lot of non-tech enthusiasts don't even see the problem to begin with. So I don't know if it'll save it per se. I think this is sort of a nice to have. So if I'm already a Swatch customer and I'm going to buy my next watch, this is sort of the nice next built-in feature of it.
Yeah. I have to say, though, I've used Apple Pay with my Apple Watch, and it is fun. It's really kind of a thrill.
How's your bank account doing with that?
Empty. Empty, thank you. Starting with buying the Apple Watch itself. Right. That's the first thing that cleaned out my account. All right, well, in product obituary news, Google is closing PageSpeed service, which is a hosting solution for fast websites. Developers have until August 3rd to change their DNS settings. If they don't, their sites will vanish. Microsoft's Gabe Auel tweeted this week that Media Center will not exist for Windows 10 because of, quote, decreased usage, unquote. Windows Weekly host Paul Thurrott believes that the use of Media Center for TiVo-like recording and playback will actually be migrated or moved into the Xbox platform by the end of the year. That's right. He has got some good evidence that Xbox will become a DVR. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Joe, does that sound like something Microsoft will be able to do by the end of the year?
You know what? I would never debate Paul Theriault on this one. He's a lot closer than I am. So I am putting my chips on Paul on this.
He's so close to Microsoft that we have actually thought about doing an intervention. We called it off. Our TNT fan of the day is Mike Gawley, who posted this picture on Twitter. He says he listens to Tech News Today in his truck through his Android-powered Eonon official stereo. And there we are. Bigger than life. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. And we appreciate all of your posts. Joe Panettiere, what the heck is happening at After Nines?
Well, good stuff, Mike, actually. I'm catching up with a CEO of a cloud company. He just joined the company. His name is Sam Gutman. Now, I've known Sam for years. And if you go to afternines.com and look for our podcast page, we're going to have an interview with Sam tomorrow. He's joining a company called Own Backup. And the whole idea here is it's a startup. It's very interesting because, number one, they're Israeli-based, and there's a lot of hot innovations coming out of Israel. Number two, they're interesting because it's cloud-to-cloud backup. It's not just backing up your PC to the cloud. It's if you have a cloud application, what happens if that app or that cloud goes dark and potentially forever? Basically, Sam's company is able to take that data and move it to other clouds. So that's a forthcoming conversation. Should be up by tomorrow, and that's with Sam Gutman. Look for it.
I'm so fascinated by the Israeli tech scene because so much of the technology that's coming out of Israel is unique. It's not just, you know, Me Too kind of technology. You find a lot of that in Silicon Valley, but it's, you know, they're doing something nobody else is doing. And then and then Silicon Valley companies that are, you know, drowning in cash can buy these things for really amazing prices, you know, a few million dollars compared to, you know, billions of dollars, which is, you know, typical, you know, Silicon Valley purchase these days. And it's just a fascinating thing to watch. I think in the past, you know, 3 or 4 months, we probably reported on acquisitions of, I don't know, a dozen or more Israeli companies, and for everyone that we report on, others are too small or whatever to report on. And it's just a thriving scene, and it's just fascinating to watch. I can't wait to listen to that podcast. And so, Joe, thank you so much, and thanks for coming on Thursday. Feels like Tuesday today. And we'll see you next time, okay?
Sounds great, Mike. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Well, you can subscribe to the high-definition video version of Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern at live.twit.tv. If you're ever near the Brick House, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send email to tickets@twit.tv in advance. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice and tag 3 friends along with your recommendation to subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV, and you can follow me personally on Google+. That's googleplus.com/+Mike Elgin. Also, don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.